There's a slight pause, and then D.I. McCoy says, "And you think Zach might have responded negatively to this?"
"I don't..." Kim draws in her breath. "I don't know what I think. But it is just possible," she says, "that they got into a row on their way home from Scarlett's house, and Zach lost his temper, and something happened, and now he's hiding somewhere. It's possible, that's all." But even as the words leave her mouth, she knows it's not just possible, it's likely. What's the aphorism? It's always the husband.
"Right," says D.I. McCoy. "Well, I think we now have enough to go on to launch a search party. Leave it with me, Mrs. Knox."
"Ms."
"Sorry, Ms. Leave it with me. And I'll be in touch with exact timings, etc."
"We searched a bit already," she says. "On Saturday, a few of us in the woods."
"Oh.
I mean, we didn't find anything. We didn't, at least, I think we didn't touch anything or disturb anything. I think it's..."
"It's fine," he cuts in. "I'm sure it's fine. Anyway, I'll be in touch with details as soon as I have them. And just before I go, I'd like to talk to Zach's family. Do you happen to have a phone number or an address?"
"Yes, of course."
She reels off Meg's address and then says, "You won't say anything to them, will you, about what I said about Zach? I mean, we have a grandchild in common. I can't have something like that between us. It would be incredibly difficult. It would..."
He cuts in again. "Absolutely not," he says. "Please don't worry about that. We'll be very discreet."
"Thank you. Thank you so much."
She looks at Noah as she ends the call. He's in his high chair eating dry Cheerios off the tray top. He looks back at her and he smiles.
"CEOs,"
he says, his eyes blazing with pride, his finger pointing at the cereal hoops.
"CEOs."
Kim closes her eyes.
"Yes,"
she says, mustering some spirit.
"Yes, Cheerios. Well done, clever boy. You are such a clever boy."
Her voice catches and she turns away. Noah's second word. And Tallulah has missed them both. The search of the woods begins in Upley Fold that lunchtime. It's what Kim wanted, but it's also terrifying. The sudden burst of energy and people, when for so many hours it's just been her alone, rattles her. She sees Megs and Simon standing at the edge of the woods as she approaches. Megs turns and looks at her, and Kim sees something like fear pass across her implacable face. She says something to Simon, and Simon glances up.
"This is mad," Meg says to Kim as she nears her. "I mean, I know it's odd that they've not been home. I get that, but still, this is..."
She spreads her hand out in an arc to describe the squad of police officers in high-vis attire, the sniffer dogs.
"It's all a bit OTT, isn't it?"
Kim doesn't reply immediately. She's not sure what to say.
"Did they come and talk to you?" she asks finally.
"The police?"
"Yeah, bloody ridiculous. They were there for ages, asking all these questions about Zach, about what sort of boy he was, about how he got on at school, about his job. I was just like, what on earth are you asking me all this for? It's almost like they think he's done something wrong."
She says this glibly, but Kim catches a glint of something hard in her eye as she glances up at her. Ryan is at home with Noah, and the police have asked family not to join in the search yet. So for now, it is just Kim, Megs, and Simon standing together, while the detectives loiter in a huddle a few metres away, and the search team and their dogs arrange themselves to head into the woods. It's warm again today, and Kim feels clammy and anxious.
"How long do you think this'll take?"
Megs calls out starkly to the group of plainclothes detectives. D.I. McCoy turns at the question, gives his colleagues a look before walking over to join them.
"Well," he says, "there's no way of knowing. Luckily, at this time of year, we have daylight on our side, so we can just keep going until it gets dark. And then it depends what we find." We're sending one party through from the back of the Jacques property, assuming that's the way they went, and another party through from this entrance. He gestures towards the wooden stile that forms the public entrance to the woods, in case they'd already left the Jacques property before deciding to head back through the woods. So we'll have two teams in there, and they'll splinter as they get deeper into the woods to cover as much territory as possible.
And what are you looking for, exactly?
Megs asks chippily.
Your children, Mrs. Alistair. We're looking for your children.
There's no way they're in there. Kim's already looked, and if there was anything, she'd have found it.
Well then, we're looking for proof that your children were there, that they were there, and that something befell them, and then we'll use that evidence to try and put together a picture of what happened on Friday night and where your children might be now.
You'd be better off talking to those cab companies again. I mean, half the time they don't even write things down.
The woman who runs the one in Manson is asleep half the time, literally face down on her desk, fast asleep. I've seen her. I reckon she runs so many jobs that she never actually goes to bed.
You should talk to her again. She'll have sent them a taxi but forgotten to write it down.
D.I. McCoy smiles patiently at Megs.
I think you mean Carol Dodds at Taxis First? Yes, we've spoken to her twice. She wasn't working on Friday night. She was unwell, so her husband took her shift. And he told us that every booking goes straight into the computer system, that they can't actually send a car without it going through their system.
Oh, well, you know computers. You can't trust them as far as you can throw them.
So you still think they did get a taxi, Mrs. Alistair?
They must have.
And where did that taxi take them?
They're kids, she replies loudly. Who knows?
D.I. McCoy stifles a sigh.
Anyway, he says, we're about ready to go in, I'd say. You're welcome to stay here and wait for developments, or we could meet you back at the village, whichever you'd prefer.
Kim glances at Megs. Megs shrugs. Kim says,
well, I'd like to stay here while you're at this end and then head into the village when the search teams are getting closer, if that's okay.
Absolutely.
Megs and Simon exchange a look. Megs says,
yeah, I think we'll just head back up to Upfield and wait at that end, maybe at the Ducks.
She touches Kim's arm, making her jump slightly.
See you there,
she says. And then they all head back to the road where their car is parked in a passing place, just in front of Kim's. From her car, Kim watches Megs and Simon's car doing a slow 8-point turn in the narrow lane before heading back towards Upfield. Megs issues a slow wave from the passenger window as they pass by, and Kim returns the gesture. She is chilled by Megs's response to this crisis. It makes no sense to her whatsoever. She knows that boys are less terrifying to parent than girls. She's done both, and she knows that she feels less anxious when Ryan is out after dark than Tallulah. But still, it's been nearly 3 days. The disappearance of anyone for that amount of time is just fundamentally worrying. Yet Megs is not worried in the least. For a moment, it crosses Kim's mind that maybe Megs is not worried because she knows something. Because she knows her son is safe, but she cannot, for whatever reason, tell anyone. But no, she immediately corrects this train of thought. If Megs was lying to protect her son, or the person responsible for her son's disappearance, she would surely at least pretend to be worried. But her reaction to this is too authentic, too real, too Megs. Kim turns and watches the high-vis-clad police officers and their dogs as they finally head into the woods. The plainclothes detectives stay where they are for a while before heading back to their vehicles. It's strangely quiet. A car drives past after a few moments. The elderly couple inside look curiously at the lineup of police vehicles parked on the verge and then slow down.
What's going on?
The old man asks an officer.
Just a local police investigation,
the officer replies.
Another break-in? Asks the lady.
No, he replies. We're just looking for a missing person.
From Upley Fold?
Says the man.
No, from Upfield Common.
Oh, says the woman. Well, good luck. Hope you find them.
And they drive on. Kim looks at her phone. It's 1:45. She texts Ryan. Everything all right? All good. You? So far, so good. Smiley face emoji, heart emoji. The minutes pass horrifically slowly. Every time she sees one of the detectives put a phone to their ear, her blood turns to ice. Her imagination fabricates a dozen scenarios, all involving Zack somehow snuffing the life from her beautiful baby girl in the woods. She sees him throttling her on the ground, pinning down her limbs with his. She sees him producing a knife from somewhere, who knows where. Maybe he picked one up in Scarlett's kitchen, a premeditated move, approaching her from behind and slicing through the soft white of her throat, her blood turning black and sticky on the dry earth. Or just beating her. Beating her and beating her, until there was nothing left to beat. Her beautiful face mashed into a pulp, he staggering breathlessly through the woods afterwards, with bruised, bloodied fists. Eventually, one of those detectives will take a call from one of the searchers, and something will etch itself onto his or her face, and they will come to her car, to her window, and she will wind it down, and they will say, they found something. And then she will know. She will know what has befallen her beautiful girl. But for now, she sits, she looks, she watches, and she waits. Chapter 19, September 2018. The first day of the new term has arrived at Maypole House. Sean has been at work for days already, of course, but there's something new and shiny about the day as she watches Sean readying himself this sunny Monday. The day will start with an assembly, and Sean has been writing his first day speech for days now. He'd practiced it in front of Sophie last night, standing at the foot of their bed in just his boxer shorts and socks, while she lay on the bed playing the role of his audience.
Wonderful, she'd said, giving a round of applause. Really wonderful. Warm, relatable, inspiring.
Not too short?
Not too short, she reassured. Perfect length, perfect pitch, and judging by the way people reacted to you at the dinner tonight, they all love you already.
You think?
The affection was tangible, she said. Truly.
And it was true. She felt it everywhere Sean went the night before. The feeling of genuine engagement he left in his wake. The sense that people had been uplifted by him, flattered by his attention, that he'd created a kind of buzz about the new term to come merely by being present, before he'd so much as held an assembly or read a speech. Now Sean has gone, and Sophie is alone. The cottage is cool and quiet. Her laptop is open on the kitchen table. Her novel is blinking at her from the screen. Her email box is full of work-related things that she should really be attending to. The dishwasher needs emptying, and she still has boxes left to unpack, but she doesn't do any of those things. She switches screens, opens her browser, and Googles Liam Bailey. As she'd expected, the search term brings up 100 people who are not the correct Liam Bailey. She adds Maypole House to the search. The school's website appears. She deletes Maypole House and adds Scarlett Jacques. No results found. She adds the name Zack Alistair to her search for Liam. No results found. She sighs and leans back into her chair. How can two people go to the pub on a Friday night and never come back, and nobody know what happened to them? The mystery consumes her whole. She can feel it whispering to her through the branches of the trees in the woods, down the corridors of the college, from Liam's balcony, across the surface of the duck pond on the common, from Kim Knox's window facing the bus stop, and the ring in its box in the back corner of her drawer. At this thought, she gets abruptly to her feet and runs up the stairs to her bedroom, wrenches open the drawer in the dressing table, and pulls the box out. She brushes the dirt off the lid again with her fingertips. It's still impossible to make out the writing printed on the top. She takes the box to the bathroom and rubs it with the wetted corner of a towel. As she does so, the blackness shifts and gold block lettering begins to appear. She rubs harder, dampens the towel again, rubs more. And there, distinctly, are the words, Mason and Son Fine Jewelry, Manton, Surrey. Her heart skips a beat. Manton. That's the big town 6 miles from Upfield Common, the town where Tallulah went to college. Sophie wants to go there. She wants to go now. But she can't drive, and she has no idea how one would summon a taxi to come to Upfield Common. Maybe the receptionist here could tell her, but she feels strangely like she doesn't want anyone to know she's going to Manton. And then she thinks of the bus stop by Tallulah's rosebush. She grabs her bag, drops the ring box into it, strides through the school grounds and across the common towards the stop. The bus comes half an hour later. She takes a seat halfway down. There are only 2 other people on board. As the bus trundles through the country lanes and then out onto the A road towards the big roundabout, Sophie imagines Tallulah sitting here, as she is, her rucksack perched on her lap, her delicate features set pensively, the sun glittering off her nose ring, her dark hair covering half her face. The ride into Manton takes 20 minutes. The stop on the high street is the end of the route for the bus, and the driver flashes the lights on and off to encourage everyone to disembark. Sophie puts the name of the jewellery shop into Google Maps and follows the directions to a small turning just off the main street. It's a tiny, ancient shop with low-set windows that are designed to be gazed down upon. Sophie stops and admires the display for a moment before pushing open the door. Her breath catches a little. It's exactly the type of shop she would use for one of her little Hither Green Detective Agency books, replete with a slightly comical-looking owner behind the glass-topped display cabinet, sitting on a tall stool, reading a hardback book. He's terribly small, with close-cropped white hair and red-framed glasses, and when he glances up at her, his face breaks into a smile of pure joy.
"Good morning, madam," he says. "And how are you today?"
"I'm very well, thank you."
"And how can I help you?"
"I have a strange request, actually," she says, putting her hand into her bag. The man jumps off his chair and puts his hand up in the air.
"Don't shoot,"
he says.
"Don't shoot, just take what you want."
Sophie stares at him blankly for a moment. The man laughs over loudly.
"Just kidding,"
he says. And Sophie thinks, there you go. You should never take a man wearing red glasses seriously. "Oh," she says, "good." Then she takes the ring box out of her bag and puts it on the counter between them. "I found this," she says, "buried at the end of my garden. I wondered if you had any idea who it might belong to. I mean, I don't know if you keep records anywhere."
"Well, yes, I most certainly do."
He pats the cover of a large leather-bound ledger on the desk to his left.
"Everything is in there from the day I got the keys to this shop, back in 1979. So let's have a look here, shall we?"
He opens up the small box and takes out the ring between his thumb and his index finger. Then he holds it under a bright light on a bendy post, using a small eyeglass to examine it.
"Well," he says, "I'd like to say I remember this ring immediately. I do tend to pride myself on committing everything I sell to memory. But obviously some pieces carry more resonance than others, and this carries little resonance. But I can tell you, it's contemporary, not antique. The hallmark says 2011. It's 9-carat gold, and while that is a very nice sparkly little diamond indeed, it is not of great value. But," he says, flashing her a wicked look, "thankfully, I am a man who values the importance of good systems, and one of the things I do to everything that passes through this shop is to assign it a number in case of robbery or theft, insurance claims, you know, so.
He pulls the ring box towards himself and hooks his fingers under the blue velvet-covered filling. He levers it out and turns it over. And there, stuck to the underside, is a tiny sticker.
There,
he says, lowering the eyeglass and beaming at Sophie.
Number 8877. So, now all I need to do is cross-reference with my Bible here.
He's thoroughly enjoying himself, Sophie can tell. She smiles blandly as he slowly flips through the pages of his ledger, running his finger down lines of text, humming quietly under his breath as he does so, and then suddenly he stops, stabs the page with his fingertip, and says,
Eureka! There it is. The ring was bought in June 2017 by a man called Zach Alistair. He paid £350 for it.
A chill goes up and down Sophie's spine so fast it almost winds her. Zach Alistair?
Yes, of Upfield Common. Name rings a bell, actually, come to think of it. Do you know him?
No, she says. No, not really. I mean, no, not at all. Do you happen to have an address for him so I can return this to him? He pauses.
Well, I suppose I could give you the address. I probably shouldn't, but you look trustworthy enough. Here.
He turns the ledger around, and Sophie quickly takes her phone from her bag to photograph the entry. As she lets the lens focus on the text, she recognises the address. It's Kim Knox's cul-de-sac. Of course it is. It must be where Zach was living when he and Tallulah went missing.
What a very strange thing, says the shopkeeper. Burying a nice little ring like that in your back garden, I can only assume, he continues, that the lady in question must have turned down his proposal.
He looks sad for a minute, before rallying.
Are you going to reunite the ring with its owner?
He asks.
Yes,
Sophie replies brightly. Yes, I know this address. I can definitely return it.
I wonder what kind of apple cart that might upset,
he says, in a tone that suggests he'd love to be a fly on the wall. I'll let you know.
Oh, yes, please do. I'd love to find out what happens.
I'll be back, I promise, she says, tucking the ring into her bag and heading for the tiny shop doorway. Thank you so much. The bus brings Sophie back to Upfield Common an hour later. She glances at the time. It's nearly midday. She crosses the common and heads towards the cul-de-sac. It looks as if someone's at home. The front window is open a crack, and she can hear the sounds of a child's laughter and a TV on somewhere. She presses the doorbell and takes a step back, clears her throat, wonders what she's doing for a moment, almost changes her mind, but then sets her jaw and reminds herself that when someone's child is missing, what they crave more than anything else is information, and the ring in her handbag might provide some kind of answer. And then the door is opened, and there is Kim. She's wearing a denim miniskirt and a black cap-sleeved T-shirt. Her feet are bare and her hair is tied back in a ponytail. She looks at Sophie through trendy black-framed reading glasses and says, Hi.
Hi,
says Sophie. My name's Sophie. I just moved into the cottage in the grounds of Maypole House a week ago, and there's a gate in the garden that leads out into the woods. And I know this sounds weird, but there was a sign nailed to the fence saying, dig here. So I got a trowel and dug, and I found something, a ring. And according to this guy at the jeweller's, it was bought by someone called Zach Alistair, who lived at this address. Here. She takes the ring box from her handbag and offers it to Kim. Kim blinks at her, and her gaze goes slowly to the box in Sophie's hand. She picks it up and opens it. The diamond catches the light immediately, sending spots of light across Kim's face. She shuts it quickly and then says,
Sorry, where did you say you found this?
Sophie tells her again. I just took it into Manton to see if I could find out who it belonged to. The guy there kept records. He said this ring was bought by someone called Zach Alistair in June 2017. From this address. Look. She turns her phone to show Kim the picture of the handwritten entry in the ledger. She can't say anything else. To say anything else would be to suggest that she knows more than she feels she should know. Kim's face has lost some of its colour. The TV in the background is suddenly loud.
Turn it down, Noah!
She calls out over her shoulder.
No!
Comes a firm response. Kim rolls her eyes. She looks as though she's considering escalating the episode of intransigence, but instead shakes her head slightly and pulls the door to behind her. Sophie follows her to the garden wall where they both sit. This ring, says Kim, snapping the box open again. My daughter's boyfriend, he bought it for her, to propose to her. And then, the night he was going to propose to her, they both disappeared. And all this time, she says. I wondered about the ring, and then you find it buried in the grounds of Maypole House just next to the woods where we searched and searched and searched for those kids. And there was an arrow, you say?
Yes.
Sophie nods. I took a photo, actually, because it was so strange. Look. She scrolls through her phone to the photo she took before she started digging. Kim studies it in fascination. The cardboard, she says. It looks new. It doesn't look like it's been sitting there for long. I know, says Sophie. That's what I thought when I saw it. At first, I thought maybe it was something left over from a treasure hunt. Maybe from one of the residential courses that were held at the Maypole over the summer. I sort of ignored it. But now, I don't know, I can't help thinking that someone might have left it there deliberately for me to find. Kim throws her a look. Why would they do that? I don't know, she says. Just that it was our first day for me and my partner, Sean. He's the new head teacher at the school, and it was attached to our garden fence, and I thought... Sophie realises she needs to backpedal a bit to avoid sounding like she knows too much. Well, I don't know what I thought. I'll have to take this to the police, Kim says, somewhat absently. They'll need to come back, they'll need to search again, and the sign, she says, pointing at Sophie's phone. The cardboard sign, is it still there? Did you leave it? Yes, Sophie nods. Yes, I left it there. I didn't even touch it. Good, that's... And then Kim starts to cry, and Sophie unthinkingly throws an arm around her. I'm sorry, she says. I didn't mean to throw you such a curveball. I had no idea.
No.
Kim sniffs loudly.
It's not your fault. Please, don't worry. And this is great, honestly. The police, they've done nothing for months. Ran out of avenues, ran out of resources. Basically gave up, so this is amazing.
She sniffs again.
Thank you so much, she says. Thank you for taking the time to find this. To find us, to give it back.
From indoors, a child's voice calls out urgently.
Nana! Nana, no!
Kim rolls her eyes again.
My grandson, she says, getting to her feet. Noah. Well into the thick of the terrible twos. Honestly, I love him to death, but I'm looking forward to him going back to nursery school next week.
She goes to the front door, the ring held in her fist. She looks back at Sophie and says,
I feel like I know you. Have we met?
You served me a cappuccino in the pub the other day.
Oh, she says. Yes, that's right.
She waves the ring box at her and smiles.
Thanks so much. I can't tell you how grateful I am to you, truly.
Kim lets herself back into her house, and from the open window, Sophie hears her talking to her grandson.
Look, she's saying. Look what a kind lady found. It's a ring that your daddy bought to give your mummy, but he never had the chance. What do you think?
Isn't it pretty?
Chapter 20, February 2017. Each day that term, Tallulah arrives at college, scanning every corner of campus for Scarlett's furry coat, listening out for the lackadaisical drawl of her voice, feeling for the energy that always spins in hoops round her. But there's nothing. The intense buzz of Scarlett is gone, taking everything else with it in its wake. Days that had once felt piquant with possibility now feel flat and muffled, and Tallulah becomes once again the studious teen mum with a weight on her shoulders. But the weight on her shoulders isn't Noah. The weight on her shoulders is Zach. He is good. He is so good with Noah. He doesn't resent nighttime wake-ups, sharing a bed with a wriggling baby, changing nappies, endless walks around the common with the buggy. He's happy to sit and peel through the same fabric books time after time after time, repeating the same words again and again. He bathes Noah, towel dries Noah, buttons Noah into baby grows, mashes up food for him, spoons it into his mouth, cleans up after him, carries him when he doesn't want to be put down, sits for ages at the side of his cot when he goes down for his daytime naps, sings to him, tickles him, loves him, loves him, loves him. But the same intensity of love he uses to coddle his baby boy, he also shows to Tallulah. And Tallulah doesn't want it. She loves Zach, but she loves him more as the father of her child than as a man in his own right. She wants him for help with the baby, to slowly circle supermarkets with her, push the trolley, put his debit card to the contactless machine as the total goes through. But she doesn't want him for cuddles, or companionship, or emotional intimacy. She doesn't want him to always be there, and he is always so there. If she goes to the kitchen, he goes to the kitchen. If she decides to have a lie down when Noah's napping, he'll lie down with her. If she's at the desk in her room doing college work, he'll be lying on the bed texting his mates. Sometimes she hides in the garden just to escape him, just for a few minutes, and she'll hear his plaintive voice coming from indoors.
Lules? Lules, where are you?
And she'll roll her eyes and say,
I'm just out here.
And he'll appear, and he'll say,
What are you doing out here then? Aren't you cold?
And then hustle her back indoors and make her a mug of tea and sit with her to drink it and ask her about things she doesn't want to talk about or say.
Come here.
And bring her into an embrace she doesn't want. And she tries not to let him feel it in the sinews of her body. The need she has to just push him away. Just to say, please, please, can you not just leave me alone for 5 minutes? On Sundays, though, Zach plays football with his friends on the common, and Tallulah has the house to herself. She and her mum eat toast and play with Noah, and it just feels nice and easy. On the first Sunday of February, Tallulah waits until Zach has left the house, and then she heads down to the kitchen.
Morning, beautiful, says her mum, taking her head in her hands and kissing her on the crown.
Morning,
she says, hugging her mum briefly, and then leaning down to kiss Noah, who sits in his high chair.
How are you?
I'm fine, sweetie. How are you?
She nods.
Good,
she says. But even she can hear the doubt in her own voice.
You look tired, says her mum. Bad night?
No,
she says.
No, he slept well. Only one little wake up, and Zach did his baby whisper on him, got him back to sleep.
She sees her mum smile indulgently. She knows that her mum sees Zach living here as a kind of experiment, and that she's watching it with optimistic interest from the sidelines. Tallulah feels a sudden longing to open her mouth and talk, to say everything that she's been keeping locked up inside these past few weeks. She wants to tell her mum that she's feeling suffocated, controlled, that Zach has suggested she switches to home learning, that Zach always gives her a strange look when she gets home, his head cocks slightly to one side,
He narrows his eyes, as though he suspects her of something, as though there's something he wants to ask her, but he can't. She wants to tell her mum that Zack doesn't like her locking the bathroom door when she's having a bath, and that he sits on the toilet by her side sometimes, playing with his phone, tapping his foot impatiently as though she's taking too long. She wants to tell her mum that sometimes she feels like she can't breathe. She simply cannot breathe. But if she starts telling her mum these things, then what happens next? Her mum will take her side. The atmosphere in the house will curdle. The experiment will be a failure. Noah will grow up not living with his dad. It is only her mother's belief in the experiment that is keeping it alive. "Why don't you go and watch Zack playing football?" her mother asks. "It's a nice morning. I can take care of Noah. Go on," she says. "Think how happy it would make him if you showed up. Maybe you could even go and have a drink together after at the Ducks." Tallulah smiles tightly and shakes her head.
"Oh," she says. "No, thanks. I'm happy just hanging out here with you."
Her mother gives her a questioning look. "Really?"
"Yeah," she smiles. "I miss just the two of us spending time together."
"Since Zack moved in, you mean?"
"Yeah, I guess."
"You're not..." She shakes her head.
No, it's fine. He's just a bit clingy, isn't he?"
Her mother narrows her eyes at her. She says, "I suppose he is a bit. I guess with his family situation, it must be such a change for him to be here with you two, with so much love around. Maybe he's just getting used to it."
"I guess,"
Tallulah says again, cutting another slice off the farmhouse loaf. "Do you need some space?" her mother asks.
"No,"
she says, dropping the bread into the toaster.
"No, it's fine. Just getting used to it, like you say. And he's amazing with Noah."
She turns to her baby and beams.
"Isn't he?"
she says in a high-pitched voice.
"Isn't your daddy amazing? Isn't he just the best daddy in the world?"
And Noah smiles and bangs his hands down on the high chair tray. And for a moment it is just the three of them, in the kitchen, smiling, as the sun shines on them through the window. And for a moment, Tallulah feels like all is well. All is good. Zack is there when Tallulah walks out of college the following lunchtime. He's waiting in the shadows of the small copse opposite the main entrance. Tallulah looks briefly at him, and then at the time on her phone. It's 1:15. Zack should be at work now. He does midday to 8 p.m. shifts on Mondays at the building supplier's yard just outside Manton. He stands straight when he sees Tallulah approach and gestures at her with his head. As she walks, she can see him casing the environment, his eyes behind her, around her, as if he's expecting her to be with somebody else. "Surprise," he says, as she crosses the street.
"What are you doing here?"
she asks, briefly allowing him to pull her to him and hug her. "Pulled a sickie," he says. "Well, being honest, I did actually feel a bit ill. Thought I was coming down with something, but now I feel fine. Thought I'd come and escort you home." He smiles and Tallulah looks into his eyes, the same eyes she's been looking into since she was virtually a child. The grey eyes with dark lashes, the soft skin, the small dimple just next to the left-hand corner of his mouth. He's not the best-looking boy in the world, but he's nice-looking. His face is good and kind. But there's something there now. Something that's set in since they were apart last year. A hard metallic glint in his eye. He looks like a soldier back from war, a prisoner back from solitary. As though he's seen things he can't talk about, and they're trapped inside his skull.
"That's nice,"
she says.
"Thanks."
"Thought I might see you coming out with friends," he says, his gaze going back to the college entrance, to the streams of students leaving for their lunch. She shakes her head. "What about that girl?" he says. "You know, the one in the picture with you."
What girl?
She knows what girl, and hears her own voice catch slightly on the lie. The one with her arm around you at the Christmas disco.
Oh, Scarlett,
she says.
Yeah, she left.
He nods, but his eyes stay on hers, as though waiting for her to betray some kind of deceit. A group of social science students leaves at that moment. Tallulah barely knows them, but they glance over at her curiously. One of them raises a hand tentatively. She raises a hand back.
Who are they?
Just people from my course,
she says.
Then she looks at her phone. Bus comes in 6 minutes, we should go.
He looks for a moment as if he's not going to follow her, his eyes still resting on the group of students across the road.
Come on,
she says. He slowly takes his gaze from them and catches up with her.
I wish you didn't have to do this,
he says after a slightly ponderous silence.
What?
College. I wish I earned enough money so that I could just take care of you and Noah, so you wouldn't need to get a job.
She inhales and then breathes out slowly.
I want to take care of Noah too, she says. I want to help pay for him. I want a career.
Yeah, but Lul's a social worker. Do you know how draining that will be? How hard? The hours you'll have to work? The stuff you'll bring home with you? Wouldn't you rather just get like a shop job or something? Something easy? Something local?
She stops and turns and looks at him. Zach, she says, I've got 3 A-levels. Why would I want to get a shop job?
It would just be easier, he says. And you'd be closer to home.
Manton's not exactly the other side of the world, she says.
No, but I hate it when we're both so far away from Noah during the week. It's not good for him.
But he's got my mum,
she says with exasperation.
I know, but it would be better for him to be with us, wouldn't it?
He loves my mum.
Zach stops walking then and pulls Tallulah towards him, his hands tight around her forearms. She glances at him and sees that cold metallic look in his grey eyes. The glint in his eyes fades.
I just want it to be us, the 3 of us. Always, that's all.
She pulls her arms from his grip and starts walking faster.
Come on, she says. I can hear the bus coming. Quick, we need to run.
They jump on the bus just as it's about to close its doors and sit for a moment, breathing heavily. Tallulah stares from the window, rubbing the soft skin on her forearms, still smarting from Zach's grip. The following Sunday, when Zach goes to play football, Tallulah asks her mum if it's okay if she goes out for a while.
Of course, baby, of course. Going to watch Zach play?
No, she shrugs. No, just fancy some fresh air. Might pop by Chloe's.
She won't pop by Chloe's. She and Chloe have barely spoken since the night of the Christmas party when she abandoned her to hang out with Scarlett.
Can I borrow your bike?
Of course you can, says her mum. But be careful, won't you? And wear a helmet. Tallulah kisses Noah and her mother goodbye, then lugs her mother's bike out of the side return and onto the road. Tallulah hasn't ridden a bike since she was about 13. She's not altogether comfortable on 2 wheels, but she has no alternative. After a slightly wobbly start, she sets off towards the common and then onto the road out to Manton. Just before she gets to the roundabout, she turns right up a tiny one-track turning towards the hamlet of Upley Fold, towards Dark Place. Chapter 21, June 2017. The police search party emerges from the other side of the woods 3.5 hours later. Kim jumps off the bench on the common and runs towards the small lane opposite that leads down the side of Maypole House. The detectives let themselves out of their car, and Megs and Simon appear lugubriously from the other side of the common, where they've been sitting nursing drinks outside the Swan and Ducks. Kim pulls back at first, letting the detectives convene with the search party. She watches, her breath held. They point behind them. They shrug. They shake their heads. She moves closer, trying to hear what's been said, catching only parts of words she's too scared to hear.
"What's going on?"
says Megs, appearing at her side, breathing wine all over her. "Any news?" Kim shakes her head and puts her finger to her lips.
"I'm trying to listen,"
she whispers.
"Why don't you just go and ask?"
Megs tuts and strides towards the police.
"Anything?"
she asks loudly. Kim turns and glances sideways at Simon, who looks at her from the corner of his eye. She feels a plume of discomfort pass through her and walks quickly away from him to join Megs.
"Nothing," Meg says, almost triumphantly. "They found nothing, literally."
She stares at Kim scathingly, as if this somehow proves that Kim is wrong to think their children have come to some harm. Kim looks at D.I. McCoy.
"So sorry," he says. "Not a trace. The dogs didn't pick anything up either."
"Did they cover every part? What about the part that backs onto the school? There's another entrance there. They might have come that way."
"I promise you, Ms. Knox, every inch has been covered, and it doesn't appear that Tallulah or Zach have been anywhere near those woods. I'm really sorry."
Kim feels her heart drop into the pit of her stomach.
"So,"
she says numbly,
"what now?"
"Well, we've still got the investigation ongoing, of course. We're going to take the dogs around the village now, for a while, across the common, even though, as we know, nothing came up on any of the CCTV. We've taken some evidence from around Dark Place, an Upley Fold, some tyre tracks that we're following up. We're going to talk to the kids again, the ones who were at the house on Friday night. We're trying to get a warrant to search the Jacques place, to look at their home security footage, but I'm not sure we'll get it. We're looking at all the CCTV from here to the boundaries of the county for sightings of your children, and we'll be talking to Tallulah's teachers and Zach's employers tomorrow. There are still dozens of avenues left to go down, and lots of things to follow up on."
He gives Kim a cautiously encouraging smile.
"We're very much on the case, Ms. Knox. Just keep the faith."
Kim smiles tightly. Her stomach clenches with anger and fear and dread. Anger that no one can tell her where her child is. Fear that no one ever will. And dread of what it would feel like to find out that Zach had hurt Tallulah.
"Well," says Megs, sighing loudly. "I guess that's as much as we can hope for now. So we can all just, you know, get on with our days."
The knot in Kim's stomach hardens, and she turns to Megs, and she says,
"What the fuck is the matter with you, huh? I mean, what the fuck is the fucking matter with you? Our kids have been missing for 3 days, 3 days, and all you can do is moan and tut and sigh and act like this is all some kind of massive inconvenience. Well, I'm so sorry to drag you out of the pub, out of your back garden, so sorry to keep you from getting on with your day. And what even is your day, Megs, hey? What do you even do? Because I tell you one thing you don't do, and that's give a shit about any of your fucking children, not to mention your only fucking grandchild."
Kim reels as she feels her tirade come to an end. She closes her eyes hard and then opens them again. She feels D.I. McCoy's hand on her arm and she shakes it off.
"I'm fine,"
she says in a dark whisper.
"I'm fine. I'm going home."
She straightens up and says,
"Thank you, Detective. Please keep me up to date with things."
Then she strides away from the police and the dogs and the nosy neighbours and Megs with her jaw hanging open and Simon with his creepy half stare. And she gets into her car and she drives it around the common and into her cul-de-sac. And then she sits, as the engine dies, with her face flat against her steering wheel, tears rolling down her face, saying,
Tallulah. Tallulah. Tallulah.
Again and again and again. Chapter 22. September 2018. Sophie finds herself aimlessly circling the school grounds when she gets back from Kim Knox's house. In theory, she is meant to be clearing her head, rebooting her thoughts, trying to get back into work mode. In reality, as her gaze alights hopefully upon each person she sees, she finds she is looking for Liam. She justifies her search for a handsome young man in the grounds of the building where her partner works with the fact that if she can just offload the mystery of Tallulah Murray and Zach Alistair and Scarlett Jax, then she might have enough headspace left to focus on her work. But then her breath catches when she sees a figure leaving the main building who looks like Liam, and as she draws closer to him and sees that it is in fact him, her heart begins to pound and colour floods her cheeks, and she has to breathe consciously, properly, to bring herself back to some semblance of calm before she can greet him with a breezy, "Liam!
Hello. Nice to see you."
He recognises her immediately and says,
"Sophie, yeah?"
Pointing at her with a hand made into a gun.
"That's right. How's it going?"
"Yeah," he says.
"Not bad. I'm just heading back to my room, fetching a book for a student."
He says this as though trying to explain himself, as though she might be trying to catch him out in some way. And she suddenly remembers that she is the headteacher's wife, and thus might be seen as a figure of authority by some. "Oh," she says, waving away his explanation. "Of course, whatever. I'm just doodling about, trying to avoid work."
"Yes," he says. "I remember you said you were struggling with focus. What is it you do, exactly?"
"I'm a novelist," she says. She sees his face light up.
"Oh," he says. "Wow, that's amazing. Are you published?" "I mean, I guess you must be. Otherwise you wouldn't say novelist. You'd just say, I'm writing a novel."
She laughs. "Well, you say that, but you'd be surprised how many people still ask me if I'm published when I tell them I'm a novelist. But yes, I am published. And no, you wouldn't have heard of me unless you're Danish or Swedish or Norwegian. Oh, or for some reason, Vietnamese. I sell a lot in Vietnam." He shakes his head at her in awe.
"That's incredible," he says. "That must be just amazing. Thinking of your work out there in all those languages, all those people in other countries reading your work. What sort of novels are they?"
"They're what's called in the trade cozy crime." He nods.
"Yeah," he says. "I think I've heard of that. Like crimes without violence kind of thing."
"Yes," she smiles. "That kind of thing."
"Oh, God," says Liam. "I'd love to read one. Do you write under your own name?"
"No, I have a pseudonym, PJ Fox."
"And what's it called, your book?"
"It's a series, actually, called The Little Hither Green Detective Agency. I'm not sure it would really be your..."
"Wait," he says, pulling a phone from his trouser pocket. "Wait, I want to write this down. What was it again?"
She repeats it and watches as he painstakingly types it into his phone. He jabs at the screen with one fingertip, not with two fast-moving thumbs like most people his age. She swallows down a smile.
"There," he says. "I'm going to order myself a couple."
She smiles and then notices that he looks as though he needs to be on his way. "Listen," she says. "Before you go, remember when we were talking last night and you said that you were the world expert on Maypole House?" Liam smiles but then narrows his eyes and says,
"Why do I feel like I'm walking into a trap?"
Sophie laughs. "No trap, I promise. But I just wondered what you knew about the woods." She gestures towards them with the tip of her head.
The woods?
Yes. I know it might sound strange, but I found something near the woods, just behind the head teacher's cottage. Something really interesting, to do with the missing teenagers. And I'm starting to think that maybe it had been left there on purpose, for me to find. Or for Sean, maybe. I just wondered if you had any ideas. He looks at her, and then towards the woods. And she sees something shadowy pass over his face.
Yeah, he says. Sure. Maybe later? I could meet you. I finish work at 4. Shall I come to the cottage?
Yes, says Sophie, knowing that Sean won't be back until at least 6, if not later. Come at 4. I'll see you then. Sophie has discovered more about Dark Place over the past day or two, as well as the Wikipedia entry. The house appears in many online documents about buildings of architectural note and historical interest. She finds an article from a local historian based just outside Manton. He describes the house as a hodgepodge of styles and eras soldered together like a broken cake, but somehow appearing all the more glorious for it. He retells the various stories attached to the house in much more colourful language than that used in the wiki post, bringing the characters vividly to life. The moment when the assassin is brought down by the animal trap is described in painful, agonising detail. It was high summer, apparently. The trap was laid in an unshaded area. The man lay scorching, toasting, his skin blistering and looking like the hide of a spit-roast pig when his body was found 6 days later. Towards the end of the article, the historian makes brief mention of the most recent inhabitants. Currently, Dark Place is under private ownership, the main home of a family originally from the Channel Islands. Planning applications show that they have added a glass extension to the rear of the central Georgian wing and installed a swimming pool at the back, with a separate pool house designed to echo the surrounding architecture and bounded by a sweep of reclaimed Palladian-style pillars, said to have once belonged to a mansion just outside York, burned to the ground by a vengeful lover. A suitable addition to a house that has never stopped evolving and never stopped finding tales to tell about itself and its inhabitants. There was one section in particular that had really grabbed Sophie's attention. About halfway through the article, the historian casually tosses in the lines. There has long been a rumour of an escape tunnel linking Dark Place to the woods that abut it, dug during the English Civil War, but evidence of either an entrance or an exit to this tunnel has never been found, despite concerted efforts from inhabitants over the years. A shiver had run down Sophie's spine as she read the lines. She checks the time now and sees that it's nearly 4. She turns her phone camera to selfie mode and inspects her face. Feeling she looks a little lackluster, she applies an extra coat of mascara and some tinted lip balm. A moment later, there's a knock at the front door.
It's me, Liam.
She pulls the fronts of her cardigan together over her summer dress, which is slightly too low cut for a doorstep greeting.
Hi,
she says. Thank you, so nice of you to spare the time. He smiles nervously.
I strongly suspect I won't be of much use, to be honest, but I'm happy to try. Shall I?
He indicates the hallway behind her. He follows her through the kitchen and into the back garden. She holds the back gate open for him and turns to face the sign. Liam stares at the sign for a moment, mutely.
Weird,
he says, eventually.
Did you?
He mimes a digging action.
Yes, I did, and I found...
She scrolls through the photos on her phone. This. She turns the camera to face him and shows him the photo of the ring. She watches his face for some kind of visceral response, but there's nothing there.
It's a ring, he says after a moment.
Yes, I know, and I found out who it belonged to.
You did?
Again, there is nothing in Liam's reaction to suggest that he knows anything about this ring, its provenance or its backstory. Yes, I went to the jewellery shop, and apparently it was bought in June 2017 by someone called Zach Alistair.
She sees a small charge pass through him. The shop owner gave me his address, she continues. I went there yesterday and gave it to the woman who lives there, Kim Knox, Tallulah's mum. She waits a beat before framing her next question. She doesn't want to say the wrong thing and put him off talking. What happened? She begins. I mean, that night. What's your take on it? He sighs and looks at his feet. Then he looks up at her and says, How long have you got? Part 2. Chapter 23. Liam had been at Maypole House for over 2 years already when Scarlett Jax turned up halfway through the school year. She wasn't a boarder like him, she was a day girl, a local just arrived in the area from Guernsey. She appeared in the refectory on the first morning of that spring term wearing earmuffs and a miniskirt. She still dressed like a girl at that time. Her hair was dark and worn in two plaits with a blunt fringe. She had a piercing in her eyebrow and peered out of a huge green scarf wrapped high up her neck like a viper appearing from a basket, shivering lightly in a thin lamb's wool sweater, even though it was warm in the school hall. Liam watched her grabbing food from the display. Bread rolls, ham, a bowl of cornflakes, hot chocolate, a boiled egg. You could always tell the new kids by how high they stacked their breakfast trays. She stood for a moment then, her tray held in front of her, elbows out like baby bird wings, looking around over the top of her huge scarf. Liam saw her shiver again before heading towards an empty table next to a radiator. He watched her for a moment, peeling her egg, with pink painted fingernails. Liam didn't see her again for a few days. The next time he did, she was surrounded by people. A different proposition entirely. A queen bee. No shivering, no anxious eyes over the top of a scarf that covered half her face. In under a week, she'd gone from being adorable to unapproachable. Liam pursued Scarlett quite openly during those dark January days. He was a farmer, a country boy. If you liked a girl, there was no point sitting about hoping she'd get the message. At first, she seemed resistant to his charms. Clearly, he wasn't her usual type. He was too wholesome, too clean-cut, not clever enough, not weird enough. You know what the issue is, Liam Bailey? She said to him in the student bar one night. You're too good-looking. I can't deal with how good-looking you are. And he'd punched the air and said, Yes! Because being too good-looking was a hurdle they could clear. They finally kissed during the February half-term break, when the school was almost empty and most of Scarlett's friends had gone home. She invited him to the local riding school and they took some horses out for the day. She wore a navy jumper and a navy quilted coat that he suspected belonged to her mother, and with her riding helmet on, she suddenly looked like one of the girls from home. She had rosy cheeks when they kissed. The air around them full of the glitter of their breath. And Liam knew then that he was, for the first time in his life, madly, properly, just like his mum and dadly, in love. When half term finished and her friends returned to the Maypole, Liam had expected to be sidelined, but instead he was welcomed into the inner sanctum of Scarlett's clique. Mimi, Jaden, Rocky, Rue. They were all studying arty subjects and were colourful, intense characters, very different from Liam. They treated him like a mascot, like a pet bear. They teased him and called him Boobs because they thought he looked like Michael Bublé, although he didn't, not even slightly. They copied his faint West Country burr and made jokes about shagging sheep and marrying cousins. And Liam didn't mind in the least because that was his sense of humour too. He loved teasing people and getting a rise out of them. He called Scarlett's gang the groupies because they only hung out together when Scarlett was around. They never hung out without her. And often you'd see one of them alone, just sort of loitering about campus, staring at their phone. And Liam would say, What are you doing? Waiting for Scarlett? They'd reply.
Scarlett changed over that first year, went from the sort of girl who liked riding horses occasionally and plaited her hair to the sort of